Thank you for joining us. I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm, who's off to join some public radio listeners on a cruise. Books about economics and the economy don't often rise to the top of bestseller lists, but in 2005, economist Steve Levitt and writer Stephen Dubner co-authored Freakonomics, a book that challenged conventional wisdom about many of our everyday assumptions. It sold, to me, an amazing 4 million copies worldwide. They're back now with a new book that continues their unorthodox take on conventional wisdom and how and why we make everyday decisions. It's titled Super Freakonomics. And Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner join me in the studio. Welcome to you both. I should explain that Stephen Levitt is, you are a professor of economics at the University of Chicago when you get there. And Stephen Dubner is a former writer and editor at the New York Times Magazine and the author of three other books. So welcome to you both. What exactly is Freakonomics?
That's the question we've been trying to answer for a few years. In the new book, we define it as this. It's things you always thought you knew but didn't, and mm-hmm. things you never thought you wanted to know about but do. And then there's a kind of methodological part of it, too, the kind of stories we tell and the way we tell them, which I'll let Levitt weigh in on.
Yeah, it's using economics, so tools of economics, to answer questions, not like the usual, you know, global interest rate kind of things, but instead just to think about how incentives work and correlation versus causality and how to use data to understand the world around us. Very simple kinds of questions.
Well, they certainly are not the questions you normally hear economists discuss. For example, early in the book, you get into the issue of what's more dangerous, walking drunk or driving drunk? Now, I guess you could argue you shouldn't really do either, but which is more dangerous?
Well, we would argue, and we do argue strongly, that you definitely shouldn't do either. And so this is plainly not meant to be an argument in any way in favor of driving drunk. But it turns out that, you know, we draw this scenario. Imagine you've gone to a friend's house who lives a mile away, and you drink too much. Now, most of us, we know so well the dangers of drunk driving that we're smart enough to say, hey, you know what? I shouldn't be driving home drunk because I'm a real danger to myself and to other people. So you may decide, hey, I'll walk that mile instead. It turns out that in that scenario, on a per-mile basis, in that case, that walking drunk is about 8 times more dangerous than driving drunk to yourself. Now, the big caveat is, of course, you can't hurt somebody else walking drunk. But even if you factor in the deaths of the innocents who are involved in drunk driving, then walking drunk remains more dangerous to you on a per-mile basis than driving drunk. Now, what's interesting about this example is we're usually the anti-scaremongers. We're trying to point out over and over again that a lot of things that people worry about way too much, way out of proportion to their actual risk, we try to explain them and show why you shouldn't worry. This is one risk that we feel is kind of unknown and therefore raise it. But let me again just state, this is by no means an argument that you should instead drive drunk. There are a lot of better options, like calling a taxi, obviously.
Steve, I never knew walking could be so dangerous.
Yeah, well, we didn't either until we looked at the data. But just looking through the NHTSA data, the highway safety data, you see that 1,000 pedestrians are killed walking drunk each year. And when you start tallying up how many miles get walked drunk, there just are not very many drunk miles.
Of course, the key is the per mile measure. That's what makes
Yeah, no, nobody's right. walking drunk 50 miles, whereas people are driving drunk 50 miles. So you don't want to be confused by the numbers. And this, again, it's a very specific scenario we draw. But the fact of the matter is this. If you go out to a party in a neighborhood, you know, we're talking to you in, are we in Georgetown? We're near Georgetown.
We're not far.
We're in the kind of neighborhood where people go to a bar and might drink a lot or go to a restaurant or a friend's party and then decide, you know, I'm just going to step out and walk my 15 blocks home or so. As it turns out, there's a real probability, a possibility there that something bad will happen because 1,000 people, as Levitt just said, each year, you know, they stumble into the path of a taxi or they try to make a dash across a highway. So It's one danger. Again, we mostly de-emphasize danger, but this is one case where we highlight it.
All right. Now, just to show that you you range far and wide in your topics, you establish a link and a parallel between at least the business propositions of Chicago prostitutes and department store Santa Clauses. Explain.
You want a...
Sure. So,
Steve Levin.
Yeah, so I will explain. So we, Sudhir Venkatesh and myself, Sudhir is a anthropologist at Columbia University, decided to look into the economics of prostitution. And to do that, it's hard to find the data. So we had to gather our own data. We put our trackers on the street corners and in the brothels. And in real time, we used women out there recording data on thousands of tricks. And so one of the things we learned about the economics of prostitution is the following, that there is the best time of year in Washington Park, which is one of the places where we study prostitution.
In Chicago.
In Chicago, where the Olympics would have been had Chicago gotten the Olympics, has an active trade in prostitution. A couple times a year around the 4th of July and Memorial Day, it turns out that there are these family reunions where people come from all over the country to get together. And for some people, it turns out Aunt Ida is not enough entertainment, and some of the men decide to sneak away from these family reunions to go use prostitutes. It turns out to be a tremendous shock to the demand for prostitutes. So the prostitutes respond not only by raising their prices and working long hours, but in addition, a whole other set of women who generally would not be prostitutes any other time of the year, just for those few weekends, become prostitutes in order to take advantage of this demand shock. And so that's the parallel we make to the department store Santa. So, you know, portly men with white beards are able to get seasonal employment working as Santa Claus, and women in the inner city are able to get seasonal employment as prostitutes.
Yeah, but I hate to tell you this. I don't think those beards are real.
Stephen Dubner, the department, but the principle, you argue, behind raising the prices and working the long hours is the same. Between, in other words, seizing the moment.
Right. It's a short-term holiday demand shock that increases wages and therefore produces additional seasonal employment. So, you know, in the long rush, there was a gold rush. In the long term, rather, there was a gold rush. You see, look, but employees in every sector do this. What we saw in the last 10 years with realtors has been an example of this on a much broader scale, and obviously an illicit market rather than an illicit one is in prostitution. But whenever a housing boom ramps up, the barrier to entry to become a realtor is quite low. It's not like becoming a lawyer where there's years and years of study and passing a bar, or a doctor or things like that. You can become a realtor quite quickly. So when there's a boom in a market, you see people responding to that. So what we saw with realtors was really interesting. As the boom went on, the number of realtors flocking into the market to take advantage of that rose and rose and rose. The median wage of the realtors fell as a result of that. So what we saw with prostitutes was much, much, much different, much smaller, but the principle is the same, where the barrier to entry in this industry is low, people will flock to it.
And speaking of barriers to entry, so there are, of course, very few, no barriers to entry to prostitutes. And indeed, they have been savaged by competition. And the particular kind of competition that has been so troubling and damaging to prostitution comes in the form of a sexual revolution. Back in the 1920s, there were more prostitutes on the streets of Chicago, and their wages were four times higher as the street prostitutes today. That was a time when women, in return for sex, would demand marriage. When that faded away, when the sexual revolution meant that there were competitors, women, regular women, who were willing to give sex away, it was incredibly destructive to the economics of the prostitution industry.
Well, I can see that you're really into this. For example, you study two cases, one prostitute named Lashina and another named Allie. And tell us the difference between the two of them.
Yeah, Lashina and Allie could hardly be more different. Lashina is a street prostitute working in Chicago for roughly $27 an hour. And Allie is a high-priced call girl, a college-educated woman who left her job in corporate America and started her own website, and within just a few months was earning $300 or $400 an hour even more, and working 10 hours a week, making $200,000. And really, although they're both prostitutes in a way, they're really providing very different services, because Allie is providing not just sexual services, but really is, I think, best described as kind of a trophy wife for hire, that she, you know, she's the wife that everyone would like to have, that laughs at your jokes and mixes up your favorite drinks and plays your favorite music and never tells you to take out the trash.
And she had a different, has, I guess, a different clientele.
Yeah, I mean, just in case you're happening upon this conversation in the middle and haven't grasped the kind of perspective that we're coming from, we don't write about prostitution or terrorism or global warming or any of these things really from a moral or policy perspective. We just try to kind of lay out what's going on and from that let people proceed how they want to think about it or how they want to draw conclusions. So this is not meant to be an endorsement or a condemnation of any of these things. We're trying to figure out what's going on, especially with an illicit market like prostitution. One thing that's interesting is most of our conclusions about illicit markets or illegal activities are based on kind of fictional representations in films and so on. And so what's interesting for us is to take a look at what actually happens. So instead of thinking about Pretty Woman on the one hand or some gangbanger movie about drug selling on the other hand, something we wrote about in the first book, Freakonomics, was about the economics of crack selling, which turned out to be very different than we thought. We like to see what's actually going on with this woman, Allie, who was earning, started at $300 an hour as a prostitute and ended up earning charging $500 an hour. One of the most interesting things she found was that the more she charged, the less actual sex she was having, because her clientele got kind of wealthier and wealthier, and I don't know whether you'd want to say classier and whatever you'd want to call it.
And probably older.
Probably older, good point. And instead of wanting to book her for 1 hour just to have sex, they wanted to book her for 3 or 4 hours at the higher rate to have a dinner date and then a little bit of sex or just conversation.
Coming up, more about Freakonomics and Super Freakonomics. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Terrence Smith, filling in for Diane Rehm. I'm talking with Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, the authors of Super Freakonomics, a new book that has the intriguing subtitle of Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. All right, we'll try to get to all those topics, but you're first there. Global cooling, as opposed to warming, has your section on that has caused some controversy, and people have been upset with you on the grounds that you may have been dismissive or minimized the concerns of global climate change. And so, how do you plead?
Not guilty.
Yeah, both of us firmly not guilty with a lot to say about this.
But let me make clear, when we say global cooling in the subtitle, we aren't claiming that the Earth is getting cooler. We're referring instead to a set of gentlemen who are working on what are called geoengineering approaches in attempts to cool the globe. So it's important to clarify that we are not in no way denying that the Earth has gotten warmer. We fully agree. You look at the data, the Earth has gotten warmer. I think actually on all of the scientific facts, I think we're in basic agreement with the people who we'll soon talk with who are criticizing us. I think it comes down to a matter of interpretation that we're trying to put science together with economics to answer a very simple question, which is if we really wanted to cool the Earth quickly and cheaply and efficiently, what would be the best way to do it? We're not answering a different set of questions, which I think are the questions that people, when it comes to global warming, are usually answering, which is, say, does humankind owe a debt to future generations, or is it morally wrong to put carbon into the air? I mean, those are questions which are perfectly good and important questions to ask. They just aren't the ones we ask in this book.
All right. Well, one of the a specialist in this field who's joining us now is Dr. Peter Frumhoff. He's a global change ecologist and the director of science and policy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. He was the lead author for the Nobel Prize-winning United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Frumhoff, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Now, have you read what they what the authors have had to say in Super Freakonomics? On this subject, and what do you think of it?
Well, let me say at the outset, I was a very big fan of their first book, and I thought it both creative and insightful and compelling. And I was very much looking forward to Super Freakonomics. And when I read the chapter you referred to on global warming, I and many of my climate science colleagues were deeply disappointed. And you know, the core of it is.
Disappointed? Why?
Well, I think most readers would come away with the impression, reinforced by what the authors just said, that that when we're thinking about this issue, we really don't need to address the drivers of global warming. That is to say, our increasing emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. That there are cheap and simple fixes. And I'll just quote from the book for anyone who loves a cheap and simple solution. Things don't get much better than their proposed what are called geoengineering solutions, and in particular, shooting massive amounts of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, which can, in fact, cool the Earth just as it does when volcanoes emit sulfur dioxide. The problem is that the Earth system is complex enough that they're actually not solving the problem of climate change by doing so. Let me explain why. When you put large amounts of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere, as volcanoes do, Mount Pinatubo did this, for example, in 1991, you're not just cooling the Earth by reducing the reflectance, the amount of radiation from the sun that hits the Earth, you're also changing precipitation patterns. Volcanoes and sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere can reduce rainfall, causing droughts in many parts of the world. If you're not reducing carbon dioxide emissions, you're not solving the other problems of global warming, in particular the increased acidity of the oceans as carbon dioxide gets absorbed by the oceans, which is having major impacts on marine life and disrupting the food web. When you're putting large amounts of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, once you start doing it, you can't really stop because the fact is if you're trying to regulate the Earth's climate by adding reflecting particles to the atmosphere, but you're not reducing emissions of carbon dioxide, if you try to turn that off, you'll have very major changes in climate quite rapidly because the carbon dioxide levels that you're masking will be much higher. So these, along with key issues of governance, who decides, for example, how much sulfur dioxide we should be emitting if the Chinese think we need one temperature and the Americans think we need another, whose hand is on the thermostat? There are just major problems with these. I and most of my climate scientist colleagues believe we need research into geoengineering, but that's not a substitute for reducing our emissions of carbon dioxide, which is the principal driver of climate change.
All right, Steve, go ahead. Steve Levin.
No, I think we don't really fundamentally disagree on those points, except a little bit. So when we talk about massive amounts of sulfur dioxide, the models that are currently out there suggest that the amount of sulfur dioxide that needs to go into the stratosphere is about 1/20 of 1% of the current natural output of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere. You get tremendous leverage when you put it directly into the stratosphere. I think many of the climate change that comes with volcanoes like Mount Pinatubo are coming because you're not doing it efficiently. Nature is very inefficient in the way that it puts sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere, and the way that the geoengineers want to do it is much less inefficient. Now, I agree that this is not a perfect solution to the problem, right? I think it's been said that geoengineering is like a solution to climate change, like methadone is to a heroin addiction. And I think that's not inaccurate, that we don't, of course, ocean acidification is an important issue. Now, there are ways to deal with ocean acidification, right? It's we know exactly how to acidify the oceans, is to pour a bunch of a base into it. So if that turns out to be an incredibly big problem, then we can deal with that. I think it's absolutely right that you won't be able to stop this if you don't deal with the carbon issue. It seems to me, though, that most of the concern is about the Earth heating up. And what you would want to do, and also we're not necessarily saying you want to go ahead and build this thing tomorrow. And what we're saying is that this is a solution to a particular problem, which is if we decide collectively that the Earth is too hot, that this solution or others that are more, you know, more or less repugnant to environmentalists are out there, but are, I think, not being paid much attention to. There seems to be a single-minded focus on the idea of carbon mitigation. But there is something to be said for taking steps now. If we're worried about the Earth getting warmer, there's something said for learning more about, number one, will there be better ways to mitigate the carbon in the atmosphere in the future than we have now, right? There's been technological progress in many other dimensions. But it also buys us time. I mean, if we think that we are triggering the beginnings of cataclysmic global change because of the Earth heating up, we have ways to cool the Earth down, and that the carbon mitigation is just an incredibly inefficient way to cool the Earth down quickly because of the long lags of carbon staying in the atmosphere, and the fact that we're going to get most of the benefits, we're going to pay the cost of carbon mitigation now and get the benefits in 30 to 50 years.
Dr. Fremhaw?
Well, I think that geoengineering solutions as your sole approach to addressing the challenges of global warming are a little bit like having an emergency room be the sole approach you have to healthcare. We certainly want to look at all possible options. Climate scientists are largely in concurrence that we need research into the kind of engineering approaches that you're suggesting. But to suggest that these are somehow a substitute for reducing emissions, just to quote one of the scientists that you interviewed, and in fact, who has been quite concerned that he was misquoted and mischaracterized in his views, Dr. Ken Caldera at the Carnegie Institute. What he says is that a focus primarily on geoengineering is a little bit like wearing your seatbelts, and then turning around and talking to passengers in your back seat as an approach to driving a car. It's just crazy that we have cost-effective approaches to reducing emissions today. And that climate scientists in the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and certainly our policymakers who are struggling to try to figure out what to do about this recognize that we can reduce our emissions in a way that is consistent with economic development and really not singularly rely on technological fixes that create as many problems as they seek to resolve.
Maybe I should ask Stephen Dubner to explain in a little more detail what geoengineering is and what it is that they describe in the book. When I discussed the chapter with a friend of mine, he said, well, yes, you could set off a nuclear explosion and create nuclear winter, but and that would cool the Earth.
That would cool the Earth, yeah.
But I'm not sure you'd want to do that.
Yeah, so let me just restate. I think Levitt and I would both say that 90% of what Dr. Fremhoff just said, I think we are in agreement with. One thought that I would just take challenge with as a journalist, the notion that one of the climate scientists was misrepresented in the book is entirely fallacious and has been a kind of charge from an activist that we've dealt with and we'll probably continue to deal with, but the fact that the allegation is not true. Now, in terms of what geoengineering is, also I would agree with Dr. Fremhoff that it would be a really bad idea to have the emergency room be your only hospital. In fact, we have another chapter in Superfreakonomics that's actually about emergency medicine and what a big problem it is that the ER has become the front door to American hospitals. Something like 55% of all admissions to hospitals now come through the ER, which creates all kinds of problems. I think it's actually a very good parallel, except that's not what we're saying. And so I think that those who read it that way are either, I don't know whether they're willfully misreading it, I would not make that charge lightly, or they feel so strongly about their views that they don't really see what we're trying to say. What we're trying to say is this, and this we do say in the book. When you build a house, you try to do everything you can not to burn the house down. You try to not play with matches, teach your kids to not play with matches, don't leave candles going around and so on. But you also want to have a sprinkler system. If it's gotten to the point where the fire is starting, in other words, the parallel here is if the problem is warming, what's the solution? And so in the book, we don't make the argument that geoengineering is the one and only solution, that carbon mitigation should be dismissed out of hand. We make a very different point, which is this. If global warming is the problem, then carbon mitigation as the sole solution seems to be three things: too little, too late, and too optimistic. That said, there are a lot of good reasons why we might want to burn many fewer fossil fuels. It would be nice, for instance, to have fewer wars about oil. But the point is that if warming is the problem, what is the solution? And in our view, it's worth seriously considering geoengineering solutions as opposed to mitigation.
I'm Terrence Smith. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Dr. Frumhoff, I'm going to move on to other topics that are brought up in the book, but I want to give you one final opportunity to comment further.
Well, I appreciate that, Terrence. I would just say that Dr. Caldera does, in fact, feel like he was misquoted. He said so in and mischaracterized in an interview in a Yale University journal, Yale Environment 360. I think he can speak for himself on that issue. And I would just say that he and I and broadly the climate science community recognize and believe that excess carbon dioxide pollution is in fact the primary challenge, that it's causing not just warming but major other disruptions in the Earth's climate system, and that while we need research into geoengineering as a backup, it's not an alternative to reducing our emissions.
All right, Dr. Frumhoff, thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to go on to the two Stevens here and ask them about another topic that comes up in Super Freakonomics. You look at the wage difference between men and women, especially men and women who have MBAs, Masters of Business Administration, who have an extra level of graduate education, and yet there's still a wage difference. Why?
Well, that's the question we try to answer, and it's hard to come up with 100% of the pie. There are a lot of things that we see do contribute to some degree. So one thing that contributes to a small degree seems to be discrimination, and that's the good news. Mm-hmm. The bad news would be that if a huge portion of that differential was due to discrimination against women, what we find in the data from people who've looked at this very smartly and thoroughly is that there are certain discriminations against women that are ongoing. Women with bad teeth, for instance, are penalized in the labor force more than men with bad teeth. Women who are overweight, for instance, are penalized more than men and so on. But what one thing that you find is that female versus male MBAs, one thing that you see is that there is a kind of drop-off in participation in the labor force. So if you look 10 years out from getting your MBA, women are much more likely to have had a long absence than men. Now, where does that come from? Almost always it comes from raising the family. Now, we know that. We're very familiar with that. That said, women still do not earn commensurate to men. Now, what's interesting is if you look at childless women who have an MBA versus childless men, versus men with an MBA, you find that the wages are very, very close. And yet, across the board, women are still earning less. One thought that we raise, which is a little bit speculative and is based on an experiment that was conducted by my co-author here, Steve Levitt, along with a few other fellows, suggests that women and men are motivated differently, are incentivized differently in the marketplace. And to be very reductionist about it, we try to get into it in more detail in the book. Women may not be as motivated as men by money as an incentive. It comes down to that. So whether it's conditioning, whether it's innate, we have no idea. It's hard to say.
Well, they're not as motivated, or they have other motivations as well.
Both. Exactly right. Right. Whereas men seem to be turned on by the notion of making more money as an incentive, the way that women seem to be turned on by the incentive of being strong mothers and caregivers.
Yeah, in addition to that, in the experiment we ran, one thing we saw is that when there were no financial incentives, the men just basically didn't try. And the women tried hard whether there were incentives or not. So I think that's another spin you can put on it, is that men only try hard when the stakes are high and they're incentivized, and women just just try hard all the time.
And yet, when they take time out for childbirth and child rearing, there is a price that they pay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the cost, well-documented cost to the being out of the labor force, particularly certain kinds of professions, right? There are certain professions that are very difficult if you are in and out of the labor force to be part of, being a surgeon, for instance, or in finance. It's very hard to get in and out of the high-paying finance jobs, which is why women have historically opted often for, even within broader professions like medicine, to get into things like family practice, which don't pay as well, but are more compatible with a shared lifestyle between being a mother and being a doctor.
And bring special kinds of rewards. Coming up, more calls and questions for the authors of Super Freakonomics.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, psychiatrist Julie Holland on treating patients in Bellevue Hospital's ER in New York.
Pretty much the hardest thing you have to do in a psych ER is figure out why they're psychotic. Are they manic? Are they schizophrenic? Are they high? If somebody's been doing cocaine or methamphetamine for days on end, they can look psychotic.
Holland talks about her new memoir on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm, who's off on some really hard duty, joining some public radio listeners on a cruise on the Nile. I have with me Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, the co-authors of Super Freakonomics, a new book, the sequel. Frequel? I don't know. The subtitle's Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. And you take up every conceivable type of topic here. Stephen Dubner, there's one point you make about whether it's safer to be a soldier today in the United States Armed Forces when we have two wars going on, versus periods in the past when we were not actively at war.
Yeah, we have a kind of a whole chapter in the book about surprising things about birth and death. Mostly death, but a lot about birth as well. We tell some stories about how you know, women dying in childbirth is a very hugely dramatic improvement in social welfare and so on. Death is very interesting, too. You know, there's one way to be born. There's a lot of ways to die. And we look at these ways to die and we find that there are many surprising conclusions. One of them is that, yeah, as you said, if you look at deaths in the U.S. active military right now, with two wars going on over the last eight years, you'll find that often, if you compare these years to years 20, 25 years ago during peacetime, that there's actually fewer people dying active military today than before. Now, one reason, it's probably several reasons.
Well, medical improvements in medical science.
That seems to be a big one, and that's something we play off later in the book as well, because we do write about emergency care in hospitals and how it's changed radically in the last 30 years. One reason that it's changed so much is because it's been informed by the knowledge gleaned from military injuries and fatalities. But one thing that's interesting is, first of all, the military is much smaller now than it was 25 years ago. So the number of deaths is going to be smaller. But when it's wartime, it still seems shocking. But it turns out that the rate of death, even now, is often less than the rate of death 25 years ago. So, again, many explanations, probably medical care being an awfully big one. But as difficult and tragic and horrible on so many levels as these two wars have been for the last 8 years, it's interesting when we look at the fatality rates between now and peacetime and find that they're actually lower.
It's just about as dangerous to practice for war as to be in a war, I think. If you're on the U.S. side, that's not true on the other sides, I don't think, because we're better fighters than the people we're fighting against. But if you look at the first Iraq War, for instance, I mean, you know, virtually none of our troops were being killed by the enemy. It was all accidents and self-imposed casualties.
Right, and of course you factor in accidents that occur. As well as combat.
Yes. You'll find that combat deaths now, the rate is lower than the accidental death rate during peacetime 25 years ago, which you could interpret this in a number of ways. One way would be to show that the military has gotten much, much better at preparing for war than they were 25 years ago. Many fewer accidental military deaths.
All right. Our switchboard is alive with callers who want to talk to you, perhaps challenge you. Jeff in Washington, D.C., you're on the air. Jeff, are you still with us? Apparently not. Let me go to Carol, also in Washington, D.C.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is this. If we have children who in African American and Latino and poor white communities are undereducated and chronically so, might the next Einstein or the next Martin Luther King or the next Jonas Salk be there? And what in the would the authors say to how to make economic investments in perhaps very groundbreaking and creative people that can contribute to society that we're not making now? How would they go about changing the incentives to make a difference?
What a good question, Carol. Thank you very much. Stephen Levin?
Yeah, that is a great question, Carol. And I think almost every American would believe in the, you know, equality of opportunity, that every child should have a chance to reach their full potential. So that being said, what a hard problem. I mean, so many people have been trying for so long to try to figure out how to educate kids. And
she's asking you about incentives, particularly.
Yeah. So believe it or not, I'm doing in my own small way. I've been asking the same question. So with a few of my colleagues last year, and really the forefront of this is a guy named Roland Fryer, a good friend of mine and a co-author of mine, have been trying to bring incentives into schools to try to see whether, for instance, and we've started really with older children, high school kids, to see whether if we incentivize the children or maybe incentivize the parents, we tried them both, to see if we can get better outcomes. And we had a little bit of success, but not that much. The best examples of incentives being used to really change the educational outcomes is Roland Fryer's study in Dallas, where he paid young children, I think it was $2 for every book they read. Okay? Mm-hmm. So an incredibly cheap program. I mean, just a drop in the bucket for educational costs. And he found sizable and long-term impacts on their reading scores from this little program.
Bribery, in other words.
Well, bribery, but it's, you know, but yeah, it's a good kind of bribery, right? It's a very small incentive that works. What we're doing now, we just got a large grant to do something which is probably crazy for someone like me to do, but we're trying to start a preschool for kids in a city called Chicago Heights. And it's a lower income, very diverse place, and we're going to see if we can make a difference. We're going to try a lot of innovative things, and you know, we don't know what will work and what won't work, but the payoffs are so big to finding something that works that we're going to give a shot.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Carol. For your question, Thomas in Rochester, New York.
Yes, I was wondering if in your study of prostitution, if you did any study of this included any study of male prostitutes, and if there was any difference between male, female prostitution.
Stephen Levitt?
Yeah, another good question. So absolutely, there's a huge difference between the male and female prostitution. Now, it turns out in the areas, the context we had, the communities we had trouble finding male prostitutes. So it did, our study did end up being about female prostitutes. But I've read the literature, and I'll tell you, the biggest obvious difference between male and female prostitution comes down to the question of being HIV positive. In the study we did, what's amazing of these street prostitutes is that they don't use protection when they have sex. So only about 20% of the time is a condom used, and these women are having something like 200 unprotected sex acts a year. And yet their infection rates are relatively low for HIV because the pool of men who frequent female prostitutes don't have very much HIV themselves. It turns out it's very different in the male prostitute ranks, where I believe the estimates are something like, you know, 60 or 70% of all the male prostitutes would be HIV positive. And, I mean, that's obviously just the tip of the iceberg and the differences. But it would be fascinating to do a fuller study of male prostitution. But you don't find all that many male prostitutes, in part because the excess demand for sex is so heavily, you know, driven by men, and so as a consequence, there's...
Of course, there are gay men who might... No.
Right, but there's men on both sides of that transaction. So I think that gay men don't have as much trouble finding other men who want to partake in those activities as straight men do trying to find a woman.
All right, Thomas, thank you very much. Let's go to Umberto, who's in St. Louis. Umberto?
Hi. I just want to like pitch in on the global climate change that we're talking about, some solutions. I just want to say that large-scale manipulations usually result in catastrophic.
All right. Umberto, we're having a problem hearing you. I'll bet you're on a cell phone.
Yeah.
I'm afraid we're going to have to...
I bet I could finish Umberto's question for him.
Go ahead.
I'd like to try. It sounded like he was going to say when you have large-scale manipulations of...
Of the atmosphere.
Of the atmosphere, you're looking at any number of unintended consequences.
Exactly.
And that's exactly right. And that's really the reason that geoengineering needs to be put into a research phase to figure out what may happen. Now, as we discussed earlier, what some geoengineering solutions are trying to do, there are many of them. Some have to do with putting sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere to kind of mimic a volcano. Others have to do with increasing the reflectivity of oceanic clouds, for instance, to cool the Earth. But the point is this. When we think about geoengineering, it's a kind of scary sounding word, and many of the concepts that we've heard sound like they're out of science fiction and they frighten us. The point, however, is this. We've already geoengineered the Earth. That's what the last 100 years of fossil fuel burning is. We also have geoengineered the Earth in, it's not quite geoengineering, more like bioengineering. Every time we invent a vaccine, we wipe out polio in effect, intentionally. With unintended consequences, yes, some, but in that case, largely it's been a huge success. The point is this. If we've already geoengineered the Earth by burning all this fossil fuel, and if the problem is warming, can we think smarter to undo or to stop that? That's really what it's about. And that does not mean disincluding or omitting all thoughts about ways to, yes, stop ocean acidification and so on.
Let me throw in one more thing.
De-engineer the atmosphere then? in terms of, like, let's reduce emissions, because every time we interfere with Mother Earth, we end up with, like, catastrophic results. So trying to manipulate it one more time, you're not going to bring it back that inner end balance that we cannot rebuild.
Okay, so, yeah. Thank you, Umberto.
So just, I think, really important to any geoengineering solution is that it be quickly and easily reversible. And that is a feature of the three different plans that we describe in the book, is all of them, if there are unintended consequences we don't like, within a year or two, any hint that they had ever been going will be gone.
There's another plan that we discuss that isn't about overall climate per se, but it is a geoengineering plan, and it does discuss weather, and that's hurricanes. So this is a really interesting proposal brought to us by the same people who have brought to us the idea of a kind of a strata shield of cooling the Earth. And this is the fact that hurricanes are a really interesting problem because they're so predictable. We know so much about them. So if you look at a hurricane versus, let's say, cancer, there are different orders of problems. Cancer, we really don't know that much about it. We can't do much about it after it's happened. We try and so on. Hurricanes, we know exactly when they form. We know why they form. We know where they form. And yet the best we can do essentially at this point is run away from them. So one proposed thought is this. They form because the top layer of the ocean heats up too much and becomes a kind of heat engine. The idea in this case would be to dissipate that heat before it becomes deadly.
How?
Well, the plan on the table here is very interesting. It concerns building a bunch of kind of big floats. Imagine them like a really big inner tube. Okay, maybe let's say 100 feet across, and there's maybe 1,000 or 10,000 of them in the Gulf of Mexico. They have attached to them a kind of skirt that goes down 100 or 200 feet into the water that's made of plastic, essentially. They look kind of like this big giant jellyfish. What happens is wave power is very strong. At the end of the summer months when the water is heating up and getting to crisis stage, waves would push the water over the top of this float. It engages something called hydraulic head, which pushes the warmer water down through the skirt, dissipates at the bottom, brings the cooler water up to the surface. And essentially helping nature to cool the ocean a little bit so that hurricanes, if they form, are nowhere near as destructive as they are. Is that messing with nature? Yes. Might it benefit millions of people and save billions and trillions of dollars? Perhaps.
And might the giant inner tubes all end up on the beach at Galveston?
There's a number of ways that you could make cheap disposable ones. You could make them sink. You could have expensive ones that are remote controlled. There's all kinds of opportunities.
All right. I'm Terrence Smith. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. One other topic that you tackle that I'd love to hear you talk about is the question of when and whether it is beneficial to see a doctor. You looked at some doctor strikes, widespread doctor strikes in several locations. And what did you find, Steve?
Well, we did this in the context of a chapter on kind of healthcare. And within that healthcare chapter, we look at the efficacy of chemotherapy, for instance, which is sadly much, much, much lower than we would all like. We look at behavior and what works and what doesn't work among, let's say, doctors, and hand washing in hospitals, and how bacterial infection is such a big problem, even in this day and age when we know that there needs to be a lot better hygiene. And we also looked at the very shocking and unlikely and counterintuitive notion that when doctors have gone on strikes in the past, and some of the studies that we cite include California and Israel and Colombia, you find that the overall mortality rate actually falls quite precipitously. Now, part of this may be explained by the fact that people may be putting off procedures that they would otherwise be doing. But it seems as though, and this is evidence that we find cropping up in many different colors within this chapter, too many interactions with the medical setting, doctors and hospitals and bacteria and so on, can be bad for your health. So it may be that going to the doctor for something really serious is going to save your life in the long run. But it may also be that when you go to the hospital or to the doctor too often, or for things that you maybe don't need to be going there for, you could actually incur risk.
Well, there's one way to keep the healthcare costs down. Stephen, you want to add to that?
No, I think that's right. I mean, we're not telling people that doctors are on net bad. It does seem like they have long-run benefits and perhaps short-run
Definitely. There are also some things that we do encourage doctors to do. You know, the British Medical Association recently banned doctors in hospitals from wearing neckties. Reason, very simple. Do they really need the necktie to signal that they're important, smart people? No, they don't. The problem is that neckties in a hospital setting can act as a kind of giant germ swab, sweeping through from one patient to the next, transferring bacteria. So even if you do a good job washing your hands, which is hard enough in a hospital setting, your necktie may be the thing that causes the next patient to get sick. So there are a lot of things that we can work toward that will help overall care and cut costs by a lot.
Well, I want to thank you both. I love the image of you sort of ranging far and wide over just about every topic and trying to find a hole in some of the conventional wisdom. So I want to thank Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, the authors of Super Freakonomics, for sharing some of that research and some of those insights with us. Thank you both.
Thank you, Terry, very much.
I'm Terrence Smith, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.